I'm here naked. That's the truth, and so are you, and it's okay.
Today's episode might be the most important one that I have recorded to this date. It might be the most important one I ever record. I do not know. But all I can tell you is thank you for getting naked with Nate, and welcome. My guest today is an incredible woman named Leonie Hubert, and I basically use this as an opportunity to tell a very important story close to my heart. For any of you who have followed me, or if you're just a stranger, basically I have been struggling with pretty severe depression for some years now, combined with chronic pain. And really it reached a point where I kind of didn't want to exist anymore. I won't say that I was suicidal. I didn't have a plan or anything like that, but I certainly wished that things would just end. And I'm in a very different place today. It's not like everything's better. I still have my down days, but overall my base level is just in a whole different world. And a huge part of that, if not the majority of that, has to do with psychedelic assisted therapy. So I have basically taken several, what they call hero's doses, or I guess large dose psychedelics of what is known as magic mushrooms or psilocybin. And it is really helping me. And the reason that I wanted to do this particular episode is because Leonie is an incredible science writer. Well, I'll tell you a little more about Leonie now and then why I've brought her on. Leonie is a science writer, an award-winning science writer from South Africa, also an author who uses different ways of storytelling to grapple with many of today's tough issues as we try to find ways to live together on a tightly packed planet. And now I heard about Leonie because she's running a podcast called The Psychonauts. All of this will be in the show notes at nakedwithnate.com. And her podcast, she's basically bringing to light the incredible anecdotal stories as well as the research that goes with it that is showing that psychedelic assisted therapy, and specifically with psilocybin, can really, really help people. People with treatment resistant depression, people with anxiety, with PTSD, fear of death anxiety. I can't remember that. There's a better way of saying that. But anyway, so when I heard about her, I just knew that I really wanted to have a conversation with her because of the incredible, positive, powerful experiences that I personally have had. And I also thought it would be an opportunity for me to share my story a little more deeply with you and with whoever else you choose to share this with, because maybe it'll help. And then it's not just in my anecdotal story, but I'm actually chatting with someone who's incredibly knowledgeable. She is a journalist, a research journalist, a science writer. Like, she really goes deeply into her topics. And so I felt like she's a really good voice who could help all of us to understand something a little better, which, I mean, if we talk about it, psychedelics have been considered one of the meanies, you know, like it has been lumped in with things like heroin and cocaine and crack. And like in South Africa, it's a Schedule 7 drug, which means it is at the same level of sort of harmfulness as things like heroin. And the research is showing that that's just absolutely not true. There's so much good stuff in the show notes. Like, I have a link to a big research study that was done where they showed that alcohol is actually the most dangerous of all the drugs, and it's the one that's legal. But anyway, there's a lot to listen to here, so I'm going to let you get into it. I really do just listen with an open heart, listen with an open mind. Thank you so much to Leonie for giving her time for this. She came to my house. You'll hear dogs in there. It's like all kinds of stuff unfolded. But we cover, and she so courageously shared so much of her own personal story. I shared my personal story, and as well as we talk a lot about the research that's being done and just kind of get into it on all levels. So thank you, Leonie. Thank you to you, my dear listeners. If you feel like supporting this podcast, please do so. It is currently a labor of love on my part. It takes many hours to do, and I would love to be able to make some income through it so that I can help to hire maybe an editor and some other people to give me more time to create. So if you'd like to help with that, then please visit nakedwithnate.com and become a patron through the links there. But otherwise, thank you for being here. And also leave a review. That's super rad. I love reading reviews. Obviously prefer to read happy ones, but any reviews are great. I love reading them. So that's it. Please enjoy this episode of Getting Naked with Nate. Well, first of all, just thank you for being here. Like, this is very exciting for me. And based on everything I've read about you and everything that you're doing, it's like so much alignment for what I think the world needs right now and the information that's going to help us, I don't know about get through, but certainly navigate what's unfolding around us. And so for myself, my story very briefly is one of coming from struggling with pretty severe depression for a few years and also some chronic pain and not really understanding what it was, being in denial for a long time. I think that's also quite common. But then looking for solutions, right? Like, what do I do? Do I go on antidepressants? Do I go into a psych ward? Like, what are my options? And I mean, I come from a background of quite alternative in a sense. So I'm always looking at those kind of modalities and ideas. And it just kept coming up again and again and again that psychedelics are this like untapped resource of at least potential based on what the research is showing. And the more I researched into that, the more I was like, this seems like something that could really help. And the more I looked into SSRIs or antidepressants, the more I was like, this seems like something that's insane. Like, this could cause me serious damage. Like, the side effects are actually worse often than the symptoms of the mental health challenges. And anyway, so through a long process of really, well, I discovered the whole psychotherapy assisted psychedelic thing, right? Which is like Stan Grof, who was one of the fathers of that. And then that, and I was like, because I don't want to do it alone. It seems insane. I was recreationally psychedelic in my youth, and it was never really like, I don't know, I would never want to do it as a way to go into myself. Like, it just seemed insane. Anyway, so I finally found a psychologist here in Cape Town who was willing to work with psychedelics. But again, it's completely illegal. As you, I think you said, Schedule 7 is the one here, which is equal to Schedule 1 elsewhere. But I've been working with it. I've been, for the last several months, I've done two what they call hero's doses, the 5-gram dried psilocybin, and also been microdosing, so sub-perceptual doses. So for anyone who doesn't know what those are. And so I guess what I'm interested to chat with you about is because now I have had this experience of feeling like I'm coming alive again, very literally feeling like I've gone from wishing that I could die and thinking about suicide, but thinking about it going like, that seems like a terrible idea in itself because it's risky. It doesn't, often it doesn't succeed. You end up with lifelong issues from like all these. I mean, I really was like desperate to find a way out, however that looked, and to turning around and being like, I wake up in the morning now and I'm like excited about my life, like my day, which was not the case for a long time. And so I'm going, holy shit, this stuff is so important. But I'm going that from an anecdotal perspective. And so why I'm interested in hearing from you is like, in South Africa today, as someone who has researched this extensively, what is your experience of this? Like, how is it approached right now? What is your work in it? And what do you feel about anything I just said?
Whoa, so there's, I could talk for hours.
I know, I know.
Maybe I should start with how I got interested in the subject. You know, I've spent the past almost 20 years now writing about climate change issues, energy policy issues, food security in the city, you know, why the city leaves us hungry, heavy and sick. These are the kind, this is my day job. All right. So let me start with my own story. I guess I was about 40 when I was introduced to psychedelics, in a recreational way, and started using mushrooms very responsibly in a recreational space. But at the same time, a few years ago, I then heard about this woman in Somerset West who was arrested for supposedly, allegedly, hosting these mushroom ceremonies. And I was just going to do a single feature article on that. And because of my own interest from a recreational perspective, and because I actually happened to know this woman through writing circles, I was really curious. You know, this was an ordinary kind of suburban type grandmother who was potentially facing a 15-year jail term for having allegedly 2 kilograms of dried mushrooms in her home. That's what the police say they found. So I was just going to do a single feature article for a newspaper. And then I started looking at outside of the country at a lot of the clinical trials where these really legitimate medical labs, medical research units were doing clinical trials on using psilocybin from mushrooms to treat things like depression and end-of-life anxiety and substance dependence. And I was just blown away by the story, and I thought there's more than one story here. There's a whole book.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get the local publishing industry to bite. Either it was too weird, too fringe, or maybe a little bit too radioactive, to borrow the term from Sam Harris. So I thought, you know, the story is way too important for it to be buried by conservative ideas or, you know, the financial constraints of the publishing industry. So I thought I would just self-publish something. And I was going to write a book, but of course books don't sell well in South Africa and they're expensive. Mm. So I thought, why don't I just take it a step further and launch into a podcast? And basically doing what you're doing, except, excuse me, instead of doing this kind of conversational podcast, I decided I would write a series of stories where each chapter or each episode is a standalone story, a scripted story that draws the stories of people in the underground community here in South Africa who are using psilocybin, either as you are for treating depression or something, or else just for their own self-actualization. Yeah. So taking those stories, meeting these fascinating people, hearing their tales, and then weaving it together with the clinical trials, the information coming from abroad. You know, this is hardcore, peer-reviewed, cutting-edge science. So then I'd launched into this podcast, which has allowed me to kind of bring into the country in a popular science way this important research, which otherwise is not getting covered by the medical community here or the health writers. I mean, I'm astonished that the findings from abroad are so exciting around this as a breakthrough medical technology for treating mental illness, that I'm just surprised that our medical community is absolutely silent on it. You know, there's a tiny handful of therapists who are tuned in, yeah, and they are preparing themselves because the medicine is coming. Yeah. I mean, we can talk a little bit more about how it's used in a clinical process and how it's going to be introduced here. Mm. But the point is, within 5 years, it will be legal for medical use in the States and probably the UK, which means that it's coming to South Africa. But our medical community needs to train up, right, and be ready for it and have best practices in place and know how to administer the therapy.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's such an inspiring story to hear. And I feel like that's such a critical... The storytelling, the aspect of bringing the personal into the impersonal, into the data-driven kind of stuff and making it about people and about the journey that we're all on. I think that's such a key element, because I think of myself, again, stories and making it personal. It's like, I was raised in a family where we openly talked about mushrooms and psychedelics and weed and like all that kind of stuff. So for me, it was always like normalized in a sense. And yet it took me years to stop thinking of psilocybin as a drug in the sense that we've come to understand, like cocaine or heroin or things like that. Even when I had seen people I highly respected who were saying like, these ayahuasca, like I did ayahuasca and it's changed my life. And these were people who are running highly successful businesses who I was like in awe of as mentors. And they were and I was like, but they're doing drugs, like, you know, and it took me years. So I think what comes up for me when I hear you say that is like, South Africa is behind in that sense, because there's still that over like that community groupthink, if you will, like where it's still trapped in the idea of what people think it is, which has been sold to us over the last whatever, since the prohibition in the 40s or whenever, the 60s or whenever, late 60s. And but I'm so glad that you're telling the stories that you're telling, because I think that is what's shifting the, like, it's opening it up. And I mean, especially among my peer group, there are so many people who are out there like exploring these things. And I'm just very excited for it to be properly legislated and stuff, so it's safe, you know, because
yeah,
that's
absolutely
scary.
So I my next little piece of activism, and maybe I should give you my background, because mine is completely different to yours. So I grew up in a household where my parents were Catholic and then became evangelical Christian. You know, from my early 20s, I've been a bit of a left-wing atheist, but I would have called myself culturally very conservative. You know, I drank alcohol, that was it. I don't really like weed, it doesn't work for me. So nothing else, I didn't touch anything else. And then suddenly at 40, I discovered psychedelics and I literally had my mind blown. And even when I look at my writing, I begin to think of my brain function as pre-psilocybin exposure and post-psilocybin exposure. Because I think you know, there's no control group to compare myself to, but yeah. I think my writing is just much more potent as a result. Anyway, but the point is that I discover psilocybin and realize what an incredibly amazing substance this is, and realize how dangerous alcohol is. And my side of the family has in its bloodline an anxiety disorder that has resulted in self-medication with alcohol, which has in some cases resulted in self-harm and suicide. So I'm very aware of the fact that that is a dangerous drug. So my next point of activism, I want to have a T-shirt made that has a glass of wine spilt over with the wine spilling on the table. And at the top of it, I'm going to write, I prefer safer drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. There was actually a guy in England, I wish I could remember his name, but he was in quite a high position in the drug administration there. And he was, I think, lost his job because he said, he's like, ecstasy is substantially safer than alcohol.
Yes, Professor David Nutt.
Nutt. Yeah. That's the one. Yeah.
So David Nutt was the guy who headed up this fantastic bit of research that was that showed that MDMA and psilocybin mushrooms and LSD are so much safer than alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, all these other substances. Right. And because he got a little bit lippy in the media, the government got a bit nervous with him. But I can send you the scientific paper, but the graph that he produced as a result of that body of research has been circulated quite widely and is one of the most potent kind of visual demonstrations of how very, very safe psilocybin mushrooms are. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we do need to talk about the supervision.
Absolutely. Oh, please. Yeah. I mean, so for myself, again, the personal story is like I experimented as a young person, maybe 17, and then I had maybe 4 or 5 times as a sort of older teenager. And it was always like recreationally, but then I would have these very powerful transformative experiences and be like, I don't feel like I should be doing this in these environments. And I kind of walked away from it of my own accord then and didn't revisit it or any of those kind of substances for a long time. And then through the medicine idea of like, wait, this could maybe help me. But then I had an experience or two where I was using it as a medicine, as something to transform and to go into those healing processes. But I did it by myself. And it is so ill-advised. So from a personal standpoint, but then having read the beautiful work of, I mean, Michael Pollan, Stan Grof, James Fadiman, like all these incredible people, and the whole thing about set and setting. So I don't know if you want to talk us through that a little bit, but definitely for anyone listening to this right now, like, please don't feel overly enthusiastic about us going like, this stuff can really help, because the key of set and setting. But anyway, if you'll...
Okay, so let's talk about three things very quickly. And let's assume that maybe the listeners aren't familiar with the wider context. So how this treatment works. So ordinary antidepressants, for instance, like SSRIs, you take the substance every day so that the chemical is in your body and it's therefore effective. So you... It may also not be effective, it depends, but you'll take it for months or years at a time. And it's keeping the substance present in your body is what makes it work. Psilocybin is very, very different, and all psychedelic-assisted therapy processes are different. So two things seem to happen. Why the substance is effective is if you take a large dose, and we can talk about dosing just now, you have, so let's say between 2 and 5 grams of dried mushrooms, you have a very deep subjective experience, this so-called psychedelic experience. So if you have the powdered mushrooms, you drink it in a tea on an empty stomach where you've been fasting for a few hours, you've supervised, you almost within 15 minutes, you have this almost potent feeling of being pushed to the ground, you can't really move your body. For the first hour, you will usually see these incredible visuals, which respond to music, and music is critical as a kind of supporting container. And then for the next sort of 2 to 3 hours, you have usually these incredible insights. And so there's this deep subjective experience you have during the dosing session. And people have described that as it's like 10 years of therapy in a night. So instead of just understanding something about yourself and the world intellectually, you actually feel it in your body. And it's that... the potency of that experience that appears to be directly linked to the unlocking of depression, the unlocking of ruminative thought, and the ability to then kind of commit to breaking addictive patterns. That is one of the mechanisms. The second mechanism that seems to be working is that after the substance has left your body, and this is the startling, amazing thing, once the substance has left your body, it appears to the positive benefits linger for weeks and sometimes even months afterwards. And what seems to happen is that the psilocybin dampens down the ruminative thought processes in your brain. And the amazing thing is that if you put someone into an MRI scan, someone who's a competent meditator who spent years meditating, and you put someone in a brain scanner who is on a psilocybin dose, the brain functions look almost identical. So what you can achieve through years and years of dedicated sitting practice, you can achieve in a few hours on psilocybin. So that's why this process seems to be so effective. But that what happens in that dosing session is a very potent experience. So your senses are heightened, your cognitive process is heightened, your emotional experience is off the charts amplified. So if you have something go slightly wrong, like the dog barks or someone knocks at the door and it's the pizza delivery guy's gone to the wrong house, you're not in a position to process that kind of intensity. And also, it can be quite alarming. It's quite a weird thing to feel your brain going in the directions that it's going in, and it can be quite frightening sometimes. And if you don't have someone with you to manage the environment, music is absolutely key to deal with the door if someone knocks. Then things can go horribly wrong, and if they go wrong, they can go really wrong, which then undermines the potency of the experience. Absolutely. And the benefits that you'll have afterwards.
Yeah. Beautiful. Oh my gosh, there are so many things you said in there that I just like, oh, so much goodness. So it links to me, and I can only ever really tell these stories through my own lens. And my experience of my first assisted Heroes Dose, 5 grams dried, was terrifying. But I was there, I was lying down, I didn't have to do anything, I just had to lie there. But what happened once I allowed the terror to move through me, because the terror itself was like a defense against actually feeling stuff. And when I really let go, what it took me to, and as someone again who had lost the sense of wanting to be alive, that there was no purpose, no meaning, no reason, what it took me to was an experience of something that is entirely ineffable, that is actually indescribable. And it is what, you know, a mystical experience. It was something, it reconnected me to everything, where I felt myself as a part of a whole that at its base level is pure love. And it sounds so cheesy and so woo to say it, you know, it's like, oh my gosh. But in my subjective experience, it was entirely real, and it still feels entirely real. I can still think back to it and go, yeah, that was, there was nothing false about that. And so I'd be curious to know, like, because you said a little earlier about your being an atheist, and what is your experience of the divine or spirit or God or however you want to call that? Like, I'd love to hear a little bit of how that unfolding is going for you, or like what that feels like.
So, yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing, and it's very difficult finding the language to explain the internal landscape to someone who hasn't had a deep dose psychedelic experience. So I am an atheist. I'm still an atheist, and I've probably done about 6 or 7 deep dose sessions, and I would say every single one of them has felt mystical. Yeah. And that doesn't make me suddenly believe in the notions of God that I believe are constructed by different cultures. Right. I don't even believe that there is a God or anything or a higher power or number of gods out there. What I believe is that our brains have evolved as socially evolved mammals. Our brains have evolved to have a mystical experience. Mm-hmm. And it's not that anything else out there created that function in our brains. There's an evolutionary biology reason to explain why that is. But when we are able to achieve a mystical experience, whether it's through breath work or dancing or through psychedelics, and so many cultures have got hundreds of thousands of years, or let's just say, you know, what modern humans have been around for 200,000 years, and there's evidence that hunter-gatherer communities have been using these different processes to achieve mystical experiences for thousands of years. Yeah. So it's innate in us to need that. I think the Western society has been cut off from a real mystical experience because, you know, we've slipped into a mostly monotheistic cultures where access to God is mediated by these trained officials, we've been disconnected from our own innate ability to achieve a mystical experience. So anyway, that was a long-winded explanation for the fact that I've had very profound mystical experiences in deep dose sessions, but that doesn't make me believe it's completely congruent with my atheist evolutionary perspective.
I love that. I actually, it's very much in alignment with another quote I read from an atheist who had had a deep dose psychedelic experience and came out and said, I'm still atheist, but the closest word I can, the biggest word I can think of to describe that is God. And but I'm still an atheist, but because it's like, there's no word that tries to be as big in a sense. And so.
So, you know what I think the amazing thing about psilocybin is, and this is possibly the reason why I throw so many hours into doing this podcast after hours, unpaid, why I feel so passionately about it, is I grew up in a culture where we were told once you die, you either go to heaven or you go to hell. And then I become an atheist and I realized that heaven and hell might be here on earth. But I've experienced little tastes of both, little tastes of what it feels to be wonderfully happy, little tastes of what it means to feel brutally sad and feel like you want to die. I know that feeling. And then you take psilocybin and you discover that it's the key to heaven. You can actually have a full-on experience of heaven if you get it right.
Yes.
With exactly. Psilocybin. What a gift. You know, why would you not want everyone on the planet to have that experience? Yeah.
And I mean, I think that actually ties really well into the work that you've been doing before, because around climate, and I've been reading up that, you know, you talk about realizing that this, confronting the grief and the understanding that we're kind of in a stage of where it's falling apart and that we don't really have a way to turn it around. And I'd be curious to know, how do you think that psychedelics fit into helping us to come to terms with or manage or resolve or whatever it is we need to do with the current state of the world and the way that it's headed rapidly?
Sure. So this is a whole nother
tiny
area.
Questions.
let's hope by my Friday afternoon addled brain can get there quickly. And I must say, I don't exactly feel like a poster child for the treatment that I'm pushing at the moment, because I'm also really, really struggling with this. So there are a couple of things. There's psilocybin from a personal perspective, in terms of dealing with climate grief and the anxiety of facing life as we slip into an unstable future.
Yeah.
And then there's the wider use of psilocybin in order to bring about the kind of large-scale social disruption that we need in order to, dare I say, tear down the political economy that's driving climate change. And by that I mean this kind of unholy alliance between big business and governments that are resulting in big business getting unfair access, free access to the atmospheric space, using up the atmospheric space at the cost of communities and individuals because of all the extreme weather events that are resulting. So there are two approaches that I'd love to talk about. The first is using psilocybin to treat the individual existential angst. And I must tell you that I have been, for the past 2 years, in deep, deep, difficult place because of this. You know, I've spent the bulk of my adult life writing about climate change. And suddenly 2 years ago, Donald Trump gets into the White House. I mean, he's not just an evil man, and I use the word evil reservedly, but he is the epitome of the system that is driving climate collapse, you know, where excessive inequality, excessive wealth.
Wait, hang on. I got to move these hounds. Hold up.
I love that. I love that. If this was in my home, it would be one of the cats jumping on me.
It's so good. Okay, for anyone who can't see what was happening, it's just about that time of day where we take the dogs for their WALK, and they are now letting us know in no uncertain terms that we are late. Anyway, please continue.
So in 2016, Donald Trump gets into the White House, and I mean, he's not just a bad man, but he really epitomizes the capitalist system that is causing climate collapse. You know, gross inequality, a few obscenely wealthy elites getting unfair access to the system and driving us towards ecosystem collapse. And I realized that I've been getting up every single day writing about this stuff, and it's made absolutely no difference. And, you know, it felt as though I had this kind of naive idea that the arc of history bends towards justice and things are supposed to be getting better and 20 years of work should have achieved some good, and this happens. And at the same time, you know, we had at the time President Zuma was trying to once again pillage the treasury, get rid of anyone who was anti his nuclear deal. Again, it just felt like one loss after the next, and then at the same time, suddenly this just rash of extreme weather events just start hitting the globe. You know, wildfires, hurricanes, tornadoes, this terrible drought, and I just thought everything's just getting worse. It's unraveling. Why am I getting out of bed every single day to do this work if it's achieving nothing? I might as well just give up. And I went into a very, very, very deep depression. And then I stumbled on the psychedelic story. And so the overlap with psilocybin and climate depression is that psilocybin has been used very effectively with for people with end-of-life anxiety. What often happens when someone hears that they have an untreatable terminal illness, they often slip into a terrible depression, sense of hopelessness, and a lot of anxiety at the fact that they know that the time is very short. And in the underground world, there, you know, years of experience, people know that these meaningful mystical experiences give people a sense of well-being and meaning once again. And in the underground community, people have used psilocybin for treating this end-of-life anxiety. So while these while these researchers in the medical community are trying to formalize this anecdotal knowledge, and by this we're talking about Johns Hopkins University, we're talking Imperial College London, New York University, a couple of others, and one of the trials was to use deep dose psilocybin sessions for people who had terminal cancer diagnoses. And the response to those early trials was so astonishing that the researchers thought someone was faking the data. And basically people who were just dreadfully depressed and terrified at facing the last days were going through these experiences and saying everything made sense. They understood it was all about love. They lost this terrible fear of dying. And in fact,
that is
I'm
so huge. It's if you really huge. Think about that, like,
it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, I feel emotional. It's like, wow. Anyway, carry on.
And I mean, what better gift could you give to anyone in their last days than release that terror? And I mean, this is why I feel so strongly about calling for civil disobedience around this substance. What right does any person have to deny a dying person a taste of heaven before they leave? And this is me getting a little bit bold and brash once again. But where this ties in with climate is that there has been a surge of awareness within the climate change community of the potential mental health breakdown that will come as people start to realize that climate change is very serious. This isn't like the 1960s during the Cold War when there was the threat of someone hitting a red button and releasing a whole lot of nuclear bombs. This is, it's here, and it's come several decades faster than we thought it would. And we're going to see, you know, maybe I could give you a quick analogy. If you imagine a glass of water, and you imagine that the glass is the atmosphere, and the space inside the glass is the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb all of the human-caused carbon emissions. Now, imagine the glass is almost full, like there's maybe one little finger's width from the top. All of the emissions that are already in the glass are the emissions we've put there in the last sort of 200 years, since 300 years since the beginning of industrialization. But the bulk of those that water was put there in the last 50 years, so since you and I were born. Now, if you shake that glass and the water starts to splash out, that's the extreme weather events we're already seeing. So that's bats falling dead from trees in Australia during a heat wave. Entire schools of fish floating belly up in the rivers. It's day zero in Cape Town. It's these two record-breaking cyclones that just hit Mozambique. Wildfires in Knysna in California and Greece. Those are the extreme weather events that are happening already. Now, if you think of the little one finger of space left in the glass, that's the atmospheric space we have left. When we top out over the top of that, that's when we slip away into runaway climate change. And the thing that I'm most fearful of, and this is what I've been really wrestling with in the past 3 weeks and why I probably need another deep dose psilocybin session, is we got news very recently of this very extensive melting in the Arctic, of the tundra and the ice. And this is one of the tipping points we've been really afraid of. You know, if we slip across that tipping point, we slip into runaway climate change. It looks as though we might already have topped over at the top of the glass. And when you sit down and actually face that, the idea that the next 50 years of our lives might become so terrifying and unstable, it is absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely overwhelming. So how do we not slip into absolute paralysis and despair? Well, if psilocybin can work so effectively for people with end-of-life anxiety because they have a terminal, untreatable illness, could it be a way to help people overcome this terror and paralysis as they start to realize how enormous climate change is?
Yeah.
And this is not just me speaking. There are many, many, many people out there, A, who recognize the mental health breakdown implications of the existential dread that comes with climate, and people who are working in the psilocybin and psychedelic space who realize the potential overlap. And I think because of that, there's a huge urgency, not only to change the laws that restrict our access to psilocybin, but the laws and the cultural attitudes that stop the wide-scale training up of people who are able to support these deep dose sessions.
Right, exactly.
Which brings us back to your therapist,
yeah.
Who... you know, there is a very small group of medical practitioners out there who are starting to have this conversation.
Yeah.
So just, from the listener's perspective, because psilocybin is still an illegal substance, it's a Schedule 7, which means it's ranked alongside heroin and crystal meth, etc. Medical practitioners, even if they are completely convinced by the evidence of how effective the treatment is, and they are completely convinced of the moral and ethical obligation to bring it this life-saving treatment to people with potentially, you know, fatal depression, for instance, there's the tussle. A, if they can't administer the substance because they could be criminally liable or they could lose the medical license, and that would stop them practicing completely. So they have to be very, very careful. So what is happening behind the scenes, there's a group of medical practitioners that are about to launch an organization which... these are not practitioners who offer psilocybin or supported psychedelic processes. What they can do is they can do a harm reduction screening. This is just another quick caveat, might throw it in quickly, is that this isn't a silver bullet solution for every form of mental illness. It's specifically for depression, for end-of-life anxiety, for some substance issues. There's more and more research showing that it's more widely applicable. But it really should not be used for someone with a diagnosis of schizophrenia or psychosis, and if there's a family history of it as well. And also the second little sort of warning is for someone who is predisposed to psychosis or schizophrenia, anything can trigger that. It could be a life crisis like a serious divorce in the family or a loss of a loved one.
Yeah.
It could be, alcohol or weed or psychedelic, whatever. The problem is that if someone is predisposed, they often only show the symptoms late in their late teens or early 20s. That's often also the time when people start experimenting.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's really difficult to screen someone effectively if they're in their teens. So you need to be very careful. You don't just launch into this at any age. And in fact, a lot of the more experienced users will say once you're in your 30s and 40s, you're starting to bring with you the life skills that allow you to absorb these psychedelic processes. And one of the things we chatted about earlier, which I wanted to reflect on because I thought you spoke about it so beautifully, was your own use of these different, contemplative practice.
Well, that I actually wanted, that was the one other key thing I wanted to bring up before we still got a bit of time, but that, I'm so glad you brought that up because I also was like, I really want anyone listening to understand that exactly what you just said. It's not a silver bullet. Is that
silver
the word?
Bullet.
I always want to say magic
bullet. No, sorry. Magic bullet, silver bullet.
Someone else
both.
Said, it is both. Yeah, okay. Anyway, yeah, whatever. The bullet that fixes all the things.
Yeah.
It is not that. And I actually, one of the things that switched me off initially, because I first heard of these psychedelic medicines. One of the first ones I heard about was ayahuasca, which is the DMT, the Amazonian vine and root combined, and this whole, it's crazy. And I'd heard about it and I was starting to get interested But what happened was when I went to my first ceremony, there were a lot of people there who made me feel weird. And well, they didn't make me feel weird, but I felt weird when I was around them. And I worked it out later. It was because they had turned to this thing as if it was the Holy Grail. And what would happen is I'd see some of those people again and again, and in different areas of their lives, they didn't seem to have their shit together, basically. And so what I realized is that, like any other medicine in the world, like anything else that we use, it can become a crutch and become a limiting factor instead of an expanding one. And so what I have found to be entirely important and just life-changing about this experience I've been going through is that once I got the kind of relief of having a psychedelic experience with psilocybin, I used that sort of surge of new energy to introduce morning practices, basically. And so every morning now I wake up and I do journaling, this like artist's way stream of consciousness journaling. I do breath work. I do some Kundalini yoga and I do some meditation. Like just
I wish I was as disciplined as you. Whatever you have, bottle it and give it to
me. Yeah, well, it's just desperation was the thing. I think it got me there eventually.
It's a good motivator.
It was because I tried so many things and I kind of just, and I've had so much knowledge for so long. I think that's also like, I'm an interested person. I gather all this information but not acting on it is not only is it not wisdom, but it's like stupidity in a sense for myself. I don't know about for anyone else, but for myself, it was like, I have all this knowledge and that knowledge like eats away at me because I'm like, I know that if I was drinking my green juices, if I was doing my meditation, if I was like, prioritizing those things, because the reality of those things is that they are mundane and they are kind of boring and they're not for anyone else. They don't get me a prize. They're not like a quick, like, oh my gosh, look how cool I am. It's a daily showing up and sitting down and being like, I'm tired and I don't want to do this.
But you just got to do it.
Just do it. Yeah. The thing that has actually really shifted for me is the microdosing, actually, like doing... basically microdosing, for those who don't know, is taking sub-perceptual. So you shouldn't feel anything. Tiny, tiny, tiny doses of something like psilocybin. So I take like 0.15 of a gram. So very, very, very small amount.
If the rocks sparkle, it's too much.
Right, exactly. If anything feels a bit like, ooh, hello. You should halve that dose. And the experience for me is that although I don't feel any, like I'm high or like anything different, it does seem to have a similar little heart opening, connecting effect where I suddenly... I can just feel myself a little more integrated into my environment. Instead of getting lost in my head, I'm more in my body and I can, it's less of that critical voice telling me, ugh, you don't want to do, it's a hassle. Don't worry about it. Like, so that for me, but it has been this recipe. And then the final piece, which has been as important as any of the others, is conscious breath work, which is very similar to holotropic breath work, which was developed by the guy who's like the father of the Western psychedelic research. Psychedelic assisted
therapy,
one. He's one of the fathers of that. And he developed holotropic breath work for people who couldn't take psychedelics because of either, you know, the medical reasons or because it's illegal. and my experience of breath work has been that it kind of integrates the two, because I feel like when I have a big psychedelic experience, I have just completely let go. And so in some ways it's not me having the experience. It's like the me disappears. It feels involuntary, you know, once I'm there. But with the breath work, I'm lying there and I'm breathing. I can stop the breathing anytime I want. But by continuing it and going through the discomfort of whatever it is I need to work with, whether it's fear or sadness or anger or discomfort or pain, or if I keep breathing every single time, I have a breakthrough moment and I go into bliss and my mind just opens. And so I'm there having that experience, but I'm conscious and I'm awake and I still identify in a sense as myself, you know? And that's really helped me to integrate the far out psychedelic experiences and I kind of meet somewhere in the middle. And so I actually want to write a little post about that, like probably maybe to go with this episode, just like giving people the things that I'm doing and who I would recommend. Obviously not for the psychedelics. I can't recommend anyone does that because it is illegal. And if you're interested in it, the simplest way to get more information, I think right now, is definitely your podcast, Psychonauts, which I'll share all of the things we talk about in the links in the podcast. The other one is Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. Because I think for like the layman, for someone like me who doesn't understand science that well, or like, you know, the language, the lingo, he writes a very accessible story. And he's similar in some ways to what you were saying. He's quite like, you know, like from that straight background, like the what did you call the song earlier? Which
culturally conservative, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what you call. I love that. Yeah. I was like, and he was like in his 60s and was very much like, felt like he was just in the rut of his life. And then, anyway, his story is fantastic. So I wanted to maybe finish on one more question for you, which I think I did write down. Because it was one I really wanted to ask you. In fact, I think I saved it in here. Oh, yes. So
Can I just give a very quick analogy quickly with regards to the kind of bigger suite of processes that one can use for managing one's health? So I guess also if we want to keep it personal, you know, when I was about 40, I had a major kind of life shift, and the gift of all of that sort of drama, which it was a very dramatic period, was I discovered trail running, which I'd never done before. I discovered therapy. I put myself into a 6-year therapy process with a very gifted therapist. And I discovered contemplative practice and a whole suite of these sort of daily tweaks that one can use to keep you on the emotional straight and narrow. And then it was many years later that I then discovered psychedelics. And I realized when I discovered it that these little practices that you talk about, they're not little practices, they're big practices, and they require immense amounts of discipline. It's a little bit like good oral hygiene. If you want to keep your teeth healthy, you need to brush every day and floss and use mouthwash and not eat sugar. And then every now and then you want to go to the dentist to, you know, have your teeth cleaned. And then every now and then you might need a root canal. And the contemplative practices that you're talking about are the daily oral hygiene methods that keep your – and it's just discipline. It's grunt work. It's annoying, but it actually keeps your mouth in great shape, your mental well-being in great shape. Every now and then you might want to go for like a big therapy session, and sometimes you want to go for root canal. And these psilocybin sessions are like root canal. You know, it's like – and I mean, this is the interesting descriptional parallel that people who've been through the clinical trials at Johns Hopkins and Imperial College have said. They say for them, being on antidepressants is like putting a Band-Aid over a boil, whereas with the psilocybin, it's like lancing the boil. You get to the root of the infection and you clear out the infection, which is why it seems to be so potent. And, I mean, the findings are showing that, you know, sometimes months after a dosing session, people are still pretty much symptom-free. And these are people that had treatment-resistant depression. So they hadn't responded to at least 2 interventions of medicine or talk therapy, et cetera.
Yeah. Oh, it's phenomenal. Yeah. Hey? Like, I think that, I mean, a parallel for me is in the Vipassana meditation sort of work. I don't know if you know that.
I haven't tried it. So, yeah, so it's I'm too lazy. I'm so lazy.
It's so intense. But you basically do like a boot camp of meditation. It's 10 days, 11 hours a day meditating. And it's like, and I had never meditated before and I did it. And I properly got trauma from it. I didn't meditate again for about 2 or 3 years afterwards. If only I'd known then what I know now around it's okay to take it slowly and just do a little bit a day and just build it up incrementally. Anyway, but what I also noticed is so many people who've done Vipassana, done this big 10-day amazing thing, and within a few weeks, their lives are back to exactly how it was because they don't stick with a practice. And so it's the same thing that any of these big transformative healing experiences like going on a fast or doing a psychedelic journey or a breathwork, all of that stuff is great for a little bit, but it just doesn't last without the, I mean, it's like what you were saying earlier about meditators and people on a psychedelic experience. So people who are experienced meditators can get there just by sitting down. They can get there anytime. That's the real work for me anyway. Like I see that as it gives us the sort of opens the door and goes, this is what's available. And then we come back into these like heavy meat bodies and we're like, okay, now I have to do the work. Like this is where the daily work happens, because as soon as it becomes like going back to the ordinary every day and then building up all that stuff again, oh, it's so intense. Oh, it's fine. I'll just go do another journey of whatever it is and I'll feel better and everything will be fine. It's that kind of thing that gets us trapped in another dependency in a way. Although I don't know anyone who's actually dependent in, like it's so not addictive.
It's, yeah.
Definitely not physically. And
it works on a completely different part of the brain.
Yeah.
Not
the dopamine.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, a lot of extremely accomplished meditators say that For instance, Sam Harris, the author Sam Harris, he says he would never have embarked on a meditation discipline and practice if he hadn't had a glimpse of what is possible through psychedelics. And interestingly, in the 50s and 60s, when you first started to see a coming together of sort of Eastern meditation practice with psychedelics in the West, the first people like Stan Grof who were experimenting with psychedelics, they realized then that once they had done the psychedelic experience, they could leave psychedelics behind. Because if they kept up the daily meditation practice, they knew exactly where they were headed. Yeah. And they stuck with the meditation practice and they abandoned the psychedelics. Yeah. So one can be a doorway to the other, but yeah, they can also work hand in hand,
exactly,
complement each other.
And especially in the West, where we haven't had that lifetime of a different kind of way of thinking about how we integrate into the world. It's very much I am, you know, like very much.
And I think this is the cautionary note as well, is that psychedelics have been used for thousands of years in a very carefully contained cultural context. For so many of us Westerners, we have none of that background. So we might launch into these thinking the substances like alcohol or weed, which is what we've been kind of groomed to understand. The substances are so completely different. And that's where there's a little bit of a cautionary, you know, you don't want to use the substance the way you use alcohol. It's not a rock concert substance.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so the last question I have for you, which is kind of like, what can people like me, like the layman, the people who are listening right now who might be interested and even convinced, like what can they do or what can I do to help to change the conversation? Like what can someone out there listening do to, like you say, I don't know, maybe not as extreme as civil disobedience, although I really agree with civil disobedience because it helps to change things. But like, what can a normal person just be like, how do I get this to shift? I don't know.
So it's a good question. And by civil disobedience, I guess what I mean is that you and I are already engaged in civil disobedience.
Yes, right.
You know, we've both admitted on air that that we have done deep dose psilocybin sessions. Yeah. So we essentially have broken the law. Mm. I guess the what we're talking about is responsible discussion around the potential of this as a life-saving medicine. So the substance is coming, as we've said already. We need to shift the dialogue. We need to remove the stigma and the anxiety around the substance. There's a lot of myth around these substances, and I think if one has intelligent adult conversations, you know, let's not be prudes. Let's, you know, look at the evidence. Let's share stories. What I would love to see in time is big coming out parties. You know, this is not a substance associated with criminality and dysfunction. You know, if it's used responsibly, it can be a really potent leverage, not just for individual. Oh, sorry, this was one of the points I didn't finish. You know, psilocybin, not just to deal with end of life anxiety and climate dread, but this much, much bigger picture. What happens on psychedelics is you become reconnected, not just with yourself and with your community and your partner and your friends. You feel more connected with the universe. Mm. And you feel like you need to be a better custodian of your community and the universe, the planet. So there's huge potential in terms of shifting or being a social disruptor in terms of this extractive, greedy, selfish sort of Western capitalist identity that we've been conditioned to be part of. Psilocybin is a way to disrupt that. So how do we disrupt that? You know, I would say people should seek out the experiences themselves. I think once you've had a few deep dose sessions, you understand what it is. But please do it with someone who's responsible. And once you've experienced it and realized how potentially revolutionary it is as a life-changing thing for oneself as well as for one's community, then start to have these conversations. The more we talk about it, the more we normalize it, the more people will be willing to hear it. And what I found astonishing, I mean, I'm 46. I've only kind of come out of the closet on this sort of in the past two years. I was really anxious that this would have quite negative reputational risk or reputational damage. the response I've had from people has been overwhelming. I sit down with my 75-year-old aunt, who's a conservative Christian, and her eyes go like this, and she asks all the questions around the you know, the usual assumed risks and harms, and I answer all the questions, and she goes, okay, this is absolutely fascinating. People are actually a hell of a lot more open than we realize. So, yeah, let's just get talking.
Exactly. I think that that's such a good piece of advice, is like, get informed first and ideally have the experience in an entirely safe way. Find a way to make it safe. That is such a priority. And then share it from that place of knowing and that place of, because there is a difference to someone who's taught, because it is a different, there is what is true and there is what is false. And the story we have been told about psychedelics in the vast majority has been false.
So maybe one just final cautionary thing. One of the side effects that I think I'm picking up that comes with psychedelics use, or a couple of the side effects. One is anti-establishment thinking, which is not a bad thing. I think we need a lot of that now. The other is a post-dose inflated ego. So during a psychedelic session, your ego dissolves, which is why you have this heightened sense of connection. But often afterwards, you have an inflated ego, and what comes with that is a little bit of a Jesus complex or a Messiah complex. So people can become very evangelical, and myself possibly included.
Yeah, me too. I think
so. I think one just needs to be a little bit aware that to the uninitiated, an evangelical approach is actually just closing off and annoying.
Yeah, that's a good cautionary.
we need to moderate our tone so that we are accessible rather than alienating.
Yeah, right. Thank you. That's a very good point. I'm definitely someone who has historically been that. Like when I got into the whole like raw vegan thing some years ago, and I was like, everybody has to know about this. It's funny now if I think of, anyway, but my only extremism at this point is trying to be somewhere in the middle, like that. I just want to find a gentle balance where I can hear every story and be okay with it. Like I think
that's the way.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
It's been amazing.
This has flown by. Like we easily chat so much more, and maybe we'll get you on again another time. And I'd love to talk more about the sort of climate element as well, because I found out about you through this psychedelic stuff, but your knowledge in that other area, especially with deep adaptation, like I haven't spoken with many people who've read that paper.
We need to talk about that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I know you've written another piece as a response. Anyway, so all of these things make me feel like either we just need to hang out and chat, or we can get you on here and do it on the podcast.
I would absolutely love to come back again. And we have to do it on a Friday afternoon because it's the perfect time to do this.
Yeah, it's great. I'm so glad. Well, again, thank you, Leonie. And to anyone listening, I will put all the links in the show notes and you'll be able to find Leonie and read all her amazing stuff. And really, I just highly recommend everything she's offering to the world. And I look forward to hearing from anyone. If you've got questions, send them my way. If you've got questions for Leonie, I'd be happy to send them on her way. And if she has time, she can answer. But otherwise, thanks for getting naked with Nate. That's the podcast. I appreciate it. Hey, this is your friendly neighborhood Nate again. So that was all recorded in my living room, sitting with Leonie. Just really one more big thank you to Leonie. Please do check out the show notes, nakedwithnate.com. There are links to articles about the research that's being done. There are links to Leonie's work. Even if you're still kind of like, I think this is crazy, just keep informing yourself, stay open. If you disagree, I'd love to hear any of your thoughts as comments on the podcast itself at nakedwithnate.com, or you can find me elsewhere on the internet as Nate Maingard. But that's it. This is fantastic. I feel like this is such an important thing to share. I would love to hear your stories. If you have any to share, if you have questions, anything like that, I am totally available. I will be back next week with more. And thanks again for getting naked with Nate.
I am undone, come apart at the seams, and it's so easy. Become a part like me. That's the truth, and so are you, and it's okay to remember that it's okay to really feel it, feel every little bit. Mm-hmm. ba-ba-da-da-da. Oh, you have saved now all your love for something true. Give it all now to courageous ones like you, like you. Entering your home to be barefoot in the kingdom where you roam, ba ba da da. Your heart's a temple, I am worshipping in it, my heart's so simple. It loves to sit and be sunlit, ba ba da da. Ba ba da da. La da 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 da. You have saved now all your love for something true. Give it all now to courageous ones like you. Have saved now all your love for something true. Give it all now to courageous ones like you, like you. Only when you're running, pack your bags, we're gonna hit the road. Seems I'm crazy, but I don't mind so much when I'm labeled lazy by those filling up their time with busy. Busy this and busy that, it seems that crazy. It comes in many flavored hats and ba-ba-da-da-da. And I seem weird too, those who fill their minds with stuff, cause I like empty. Emptiness seems just enough to me. Emptiness is just enough.